You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the Art World Demystified.
Today on our show, we're talking with Christina McPhee. She's a painter and media artist who lives and works in California. Christina, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you very much for having me. Thank you.
So let's talk about what's happening in your studio right now. I know a lot of your work, but probably not what's going on right now. So what are you working on at the moment or involved in?
Well, I've been, since summer of 2013, I've been involved in a really exciting project. It's exciting to me because it means a full-on return to painting, but kind of in a new register for me. So I should back up and say that I've been engaged in kind of a cross-disciplinary, largely media-based practice for about 10 years with also a lot of drawing. So I really chose after I had just finished a large project in media arts in 2013 called Carbon Song Cycle, which was a performance work with multiple screen kind of multi-cinema piece with a composer, Pamela Z. And after that, I was really excited to go back to the studio and just hole up. And so I started working on a new body of work that would involve the idea of the canvas as a drum mechanism or a percussive almost like a percussive instrument, so that every mark that I would make would be as if onto the onto such a taut surface that it would be like the surface of a drum, really, really smooth and kind of translucent. So to achieve that, I built canvases, custom stretchers which I stretched with muslin rather than regular cotton duck, and then prepped it only with rabbit skin glue so that the muslin itself is like this beautiful translucent surface. And it kind of gives a chance for the work to glide over the surface a little bit like traditional Chinese painting, for example, like perhaps from the classical Chinese painting. Or it also has a resonance that is somewhat similar to paper, but allowing me to work with paint, with oil paint. So I've been doing oil paint and then adding other media as well, jacquard dyes, and even kind of unusual things like pomegranate stain and stuff like this, and also with graphite. But the whole idea is that the touch has to be incredibly precise and drawing focused. So it's what this allows me to do is to explore my interest in ramifying lines. So I'm interested in a really intense exploration of linear thresholds, and so color shapes that are like cascading, tumbling, sharding, turning into shards, forming into clusters, falling apart, and kind of giving this impression of an infinite extension. So that's the project. It's called Muslin Drum, and it's been ongoing now for about 18 months, and really an exciting thing for me.
It sort and of will feels that be like shown it, somewhere?
I hope so. I would love for that to occur. I'm almost at the point now where I can start. I have enough of them are at a high enough level that I think that could happen. In the meanwhile, my exhibitions have, the things I've been showing lately have been more in work that the previous project that I did in still media before that, which is called Double Blind Studies, which is again a strongly drawing-based project, but moving into a photographic interpretation of drawing. So in Double Blind Studies, I shot smaller scale drawings. Like when I say, for me, a small scale drawing is 22 by 30 inches thereabouts. So it's not super little, but it's sort of medium scale. And then taking those photographs, turning them into a bilateral symmetry, and then starting to explore the kind of Rorschach-like strange effects that occur using Photoshop so that they were, I would, it ended up looking like a lot of very weird architectural ornament, and so it's an exploration of kind of a forensic lineup of drawings, kind of like understanding them forensically. And this body of work, I taking that back out of the digital, I moved it back into analog by having these files printed at Griffin Editions in Williamsburg in Brooklyn with a gelatin silver process. So they basically go, once the paper's exposed, they are then hand printed. So they have a really weird effect of, they look, in fact, they are film, they look like they're film-based, and they're actually not, and they look like they're handmade, and they actually are. So that's the current work that's kind of making the rounds, and I have one of those that's going to be opening next week at a gallery in the Lower East Side called Central Booking. So it's going to be part of a show called Scenes of the Crime. Mm-hmm. That's on April 16th through the end of May. Excuse me. Yeah, like 16th.
Oh, good. So listeners can see that show.
That's right.
So the title of the show is Scenes of the Crime.
Scenes of the Crime or Scene of the Crime. Yeah, it's at Central Booking, which is it's 21 Ludlow Street.
It's kind of fascinating. I mean, I look at those images on your website, and I don't know exactly what the curator meant by scenes of the crime, but those images are so rich, have so much depth, and there is something kind of weird and haunting about them. It does almost look like, I don't know, like a horror image almost, some of them.
Like horror?
Yeah,
I think they are kind of scary.
There's something scary about it. It's not like
I think they are really. I totally think they're. I think they're very, very scary pieces. I agree. I mean, they. I've always been interested in that kind of nightmare edge. In my personal life, I unfortunately was. I had about a 30-year run of having really terrifically scary nightmares. You know, where I would wake up yelling and, you know, having like out of body impressions. You know, I would feel like I was sleepwalking, even if I wasn't. You know, but I've had strange hypnagogic experience, and so I think that has turned out to be. I'm happy to say I don't have these anymore, but the experience of them is definitely a huge resource for explorations, you know, of kind of the dark side, and I really like there was sort of a proximate cause for these double blind studies that related to the BP oil spill, the Gulf of Mexico in 2010. It just happened that there's a marine biologist from Louisiana who is a collector of my work. She had collected my work when I was showing with a gallery in Chelsea. And she said, oh, your photographic work really reminds me of where I live with the oil installations right in the middle of the swamp in Louisiana. You must come down. And so when the spill happened, she used some of her National Science Foundation emergency funding that she had to bring me down twice on trips to study both during the spill along the beaches and then at the about 6 months after the spill was officially supposed to be over, I went on board a research vessel with her and her colleagues. This is, I should say, it's Dr. Suzanne Frederick, who was the person. She's a marine biologist, and her colleagues invited me along, and then I shot video on that vessel, and we were out in the middle of the Gulf, and you know, it was like we'd be going to certain areas where they had studied before the spill, and some of these locations were at, you know, 1,200 meters of depth. They're very, very deep center of the Gulf, so it'd be like at 2 o'clock in the morning, we'd be out there, and the pitch, you know, that it'd be like really intense waves, and we'd be out there. And they were hauling animals out from 1,200 feet. I mean, sorry, 1,200 meters. You know, like the strange fish that have no eyes or non-functional eyes and glow in the dark. That kind of creature was coming up. Lots of crabs, shrimp, you know, crustacea, sea cucumbers, all in kind of a tumble. And then I was like trying quickly to photo, to video as much as I possibly could. And I have made video projects from this, but what happened was that when I got back, I had a lot of dreams of this event, of seeing these animals coming up out of the deep and on out in the darkness and out onto this huge, brightly lit, white, you know, this deck of the ship, and, you know, with all the pitch and roll and the incredible intense light and darkness, and these animals, a lot of the crustacea are bright red. And so it was just really kind of an overwhelming experience. And I decided that, so it really colored the way I approached, when I started trying to do drawings of these creatures that were abstractions from what I had observed, not anatomically correct, but in a way like interpretive or interpolated from what I had observed. And then I decided to study the drawings themselves as if they were like a police lineup of animals that had been like, that were under interrogation in a way. So that's kind of the origin of the work.
Wow, that's so disturbing, you know, a little bit like the nightmares you were talking about.
It was really awful, yeah.
But yeah. Your paintings don't look quite like that. Your paintings don't seem so upsetting in that way. Or are you going for that or not the same way? The paintings seem to me that the color and life and edge to them feel like a very different aesthetic than the kind of black and white.
Yeah, you know, it's kind of funny, interesting to me because most of my life, with this experience of the nightmares, the hypnagogic nightmare problem, which was related, you know, to traumatic memory, that kind of thing, not post-traumatic stress disorder. These things, when I would try to paint this material, the canvas and the oil paint and, you know, whatever else I was throwing on the canvas, it would get darker and darker and darker. It was like painting into a black hole. It was kind of like a Julie Kristeva black sun kind of, you know, endless night kind of thing. I couldn't really make dark paintings that were also still articulated, if you see what I'm saying. So it was like, they wouldn't end up beautifully dark, like, you know, an Ad Reinhardt or something. It was not like that. They were more like just dead. And this is one of the reasons that I felt that once I was able to start using time-based media in the early 2000s, I was able to then take that impulse and start working with it through shooting in the landscape. And then because it's something about the fact that you can constantly change the image through the montage and through the continuity in a film setting, and I don't mean film literally, but in a cinematic setting, you can move from darkness to light to darkness to light in a way that I wasn't really able to do with painting. So when really the double blind studies were and the related films around it are a turning point for me, because what it did was it firmly established for me a method for being clear about those dark, that dark sort of nightmare and horror content that's an important undertone in my work, and at the same time kind of freeing up, now that I'm working in the Muslin Drum series with the paintings, the paintings no longer have to have the burden of carrying forth that agenda. They're able to be released and liberated from it. So that, because I guess I feel that more philosophically and spiritually, I feel that my job is to reflect what I'm experiencing as coming at me from the future, it's like I'm very sensitive to futures and less, although I have a pretty strong historic background in his art history, et cetera, I'm more interested in this, it's sort of a sense of the future coming at us. And in that vein, I think that there's this, you know, there are elements of, you know, there are elements of this kind of sensation of the future that are ecstatic, that are exuberant, that are expansive, that are have a quality of infinity and spontaneity, and that there's like, I guess I'm a person with a, you know, inordinate amount of hope for the planet and animals and people. You know, I mean, I guess it's just this very strong sense of the tremendous exuberance of life that I can actually work with the paintings. Again, I find that if I do too much working into these canvases, the muslin drum paintings will start to lose their drum-like quality. Then they lose their translucent and taut physicality, and they start to become heavy and dark. So it's a really... You don't see those on my website because those paintings are the ones that I do in the studio that don't work out well are ones where it starts to get too layered. It's as if there's too much history in each canvas. So the best ones are the ones that are almost like a total brain swarm, like just this explosion of materiality and linear thresholds and materials. And then it has to be done. It's kind of like a Zen, you know, or you know, like Chinese painting in that way. It kind of has to be done in a short go, like a few days and not months. So I guess that's the ideology of those, and why they have a somewhat different mood, is that they point to kind of some kind of richness of life, even in, you know, I guess I feel that, you know, in the sense of, you know, we are all, you know, obsessed with, or at least many of us are obsessed with the idea of the Anthropocene and with, you know, the idea that our civilization is in a state of collapse because of environmental disaster. And of course, share that view, and I'm just as terribly concerned as all of us are, but at the same time, I also have a kind of a transhuman or beyond the human view of life and its tremendous integrity and its tremendous kind of infinite expansive qualities. So it's not like we're going to save the Earth. I mean, the Earth obviously goes on beyond us, but there's this sort of sensation of the forms of life in their burgeoning regenerative qualities. That's something that really interests me at this point in my life.
So it sounds like a lot of this is, I mean, it's fascinating what you're saying, and in terms of this sort of kind of environmental perspective and also this spiritual and also dealing with kind of horror,
mm-hmm.
All of this seems almost, and just correct me if I'm wrong, but kind of fed by you're also grappling with post-traumatic stress or
mm-hmm.
whatever happened 30 years ago. This
mm-hmm.
seems kind of like a universal as well as personal grappling with horror
mm-hmm.
and how we survive horror.
I think that's right. I think there's always a pressure on artists there seems to be a pressure to sometimes to work out of the autobiographical or the confessional area. And although I respect that type of work, I'm so interested in abstraction that I find that my own, you know, my own affiliations in terms of what my work is closest to, what other media or other types of creative practice my work is closest to, is it's less close to literature and it's closer to music and maybe architecture. And by which I mean that my work tends to move towards the more sort of abstract, almost mathematical predilections of those disciplines, and a little bit less away from image. I mean, from sort of image and contextualizing the image. So I find that although I am a massive reader and a constant devourer of literature, philosophy, and theory, and more literature, et cetera, poetry, I find that feeds, it's like that feeds the back story for me, and then what really happens in my consciousness is that the best way for me to deal with that I found that works to ameliorate and move and regenerate my life and to not get stuck in traumatic memory is to work with these kind of almost quasi-musical structures that are available to me in the painting world and in painting and drawing. So that's like, in a way, that's my sort of shining light. That's what really moves me. And well, that I also think is, I just might want to say, just to finish that thought, I think that also is why the work becomes transpersonal and doesn't reflect an autobiographical content of my own particularly. The energy's there, but not the particular details. Anyway, that's what I wanted to say.
Right, exactly. The energy without the details, in
mm-hmm.
you know,
or the details. The details are not autobiographical. It's more like the details are grounded in something that we might all share, such as I don't know, understanding of. I mean, it's banal to kind of talk about these things, but they have to do with like interval, repetition, recursion, fugue structures, things like that are all shared topographies or topologies, because we are, all of our brains work like that. That's why we all understand, certain kinds of music are universally appreciated. It's just there's structures that I think we all, that are just built, almost built into our neurologic apparatus that help us to understand the world, and those are the spaces I'm really interested in. Those kinds of structures.
It's very interesting, you know. The ideas that you're talking about, in a way, sound like such a powerful life force, and going through what you went through and where you came from, just to move back a little bit.
Yeah.
It's to enter out into the world and share your work and to share something of your experience as well as grapple with it.
Mm-hmm.
It's obviously very powerful. Did that seem difficult to do initially? I mean, I'm going back to maybe your first gallery show or first getting it out there,
yeah,
30 years ago. It seems almost like opposite energies. On one hand, there's this healing energy that's trying to happen. And on another hand, you're being extroverted and you're saying, I want to show these and I want people to see this. And even if it's not specifically autobiographical, for you it is, and the energy you're sharing is,
that's a really good point.
Both horrifying. So how?
Well, it's pretty. It's
just talk
pretty,
about
pretty
it
hard to.
How
do
you
know,
that,
I think it's what. When I was about 12, I saw a painting by Philip Guston, and I was actually remember standing in front of it at about age 12 or 13, and this was one of his late abstract works. It was before the Ku Klux Klan kind of comic crazy cat phase that comes later. And I thought, I felt this resonance of the darkness in this very luscious painting of rich reds. And I thought, this is it. This is something that's really important. I really want to study with this person. So I carried that thought and then was able to go ahead and I did study with him in the last two years before he died at Boston University. And what basically, so that's like a vignette from an early period. Then after that, there was a really quite a long period of time when I struggled with this problem of how I should access this. And so my first step was to try to refine my technique. And I just spent, a decade just really, really trying to work the drawing to an incredible degree so that I could work. I did a lot of working in the landscape and worked outside myself, but worked at sites, archaeological sites and historical sites where there had been sort of some kind of traumatic or violent memory embedded in the site, maybe a military installation from the 19th century, that kind of stuff. I was living in Kansas City and I could take road trips from there. I was free to be able to do that frequently, and I would go, so I explored a lot in the plains and the Mountain West and did a lot of studies out there, which allowed me to objectify, to project, as it were, to sort of find this kind of correlation of violence in the landscape and the layers of time that embedded in that and try to draw that. So I was sort of trying to observe that kind of invisible reality in ruins and places like that. So that was the strategy that carried me for a really long time. But actually, it did not sustain me. Well, it took about, it sustained about 15 years of work. But during that time, I didn't really exhibit that much, I must say. I really was like here and there, but it really wasn't I just felt that I still could not actually deal with the public life. And it was really only around the very end of the 90s, like around 2000, that I realized how I could enter into a public space with my work and take that risk that you're talking about of like, okay, I know how I feel. Now I'm going to like take the work that is pulling from that and put it into a public context, take that risk and be real in that context and let the work live there. And that process was facilitated by digital media specifically because I was able to use start editing. It was for the first time, I'd always wanted to make time-based works, As a kid, I looked at movies and was like, oh, I'd love to make a movie, but how will I ever make a movie? I'm a kid with, in a town in the middle of Nebraska. I'm not going to be able to go. I just had no idea how I would ever become part of the cinema industry. And I also sort of did not feel like making films that looked like Hollywood films or any other kind of film. I knew that it was some sort of painting thing that I was doing. And that I wanted to do, and I didn't have any way to do it. But then when, because of the personal computer and, Apple technology and all this, it was really suddenly totally possible to do those kind of remote landscape studies, site studies that I've been doing with drawing and watercolor and painting and, all that. I was able to do that with the video camera. So I started to draw out in the remote landscape. I moved to California, started working in the landscape here along the San Andreas Fault, and also started working with a friend who later became my partner and then my husband, and I had someone to work with, and he was able to shoot me doing performative drawing in the landscape. So that was the creation of a kind of a safe zone where I could actually do that work and have it live in some sort of form of the public space. So it was also quite helpful at that time, which was I'm talking about the period 2000 to 2005. I was pretty early in the scene of people trying to put work online, like online time-based media. This is back in the day when, I remember I couldn't make a QuickTime movie that was bigger than 2 megabytes and expect it to work. So I started putting work out there in Flash, really tiny little Flash files that were 100K, and making online interactive media cinema pieces. So that that was a early practice, and it was kind of a, with my really strong background in painting and drawing, and also I should mention I was an amateur, totally amateur musician as a child, but I learned piano, so that was actually a really big thing that helped me with time-based media to organize. My thoughts were already organized around music, so it was easy to do this. And then to make these pieces that would go out onto the internet, which was at that time so much smaller and didn't have the sort of social media web 2.0 aspect. So it was great because it meant that my work got seen really quickly, and then I got lots of feedback and lots of energy, got that an audience was there for my work almost right away. And it was really exciting. And so, like, to her credit, Christiane Paul at the Whitney had this art port project that she started in around 2003 or 4. And so in 2005, she asked me to make a piece for the art port of the Whitney Museum, which is you can actually still go and see all of her archived projects that she curated. So I did that with a couple of other collaborators and made a piece about seismic, making a connection between seismic topographies and traumatic memory. And that led to a whole big project, and that was related, actually, that didn't lead to, but it was related to a big project called Carissa Parkfield Diaries that I carried out in photo montage and video and this online piece during that time, so around 2004, 05, 06. So that's really where I was able to, I found an audience, a really receptive, excited audience in online, and then when I brought it into the real space of, I had a show in LA in 2005 with this at an artist space, project space downtown that, where I put up these huge photo montage pieces that were all based on this idea of seismic memory, where you're like a geomorphology of the quake landscape, and making that, making a connection between that and neural topographies of hypnagogic nightmare, the kind of nightmares I was having. So I was trying to make these large works that actually somehow drew on the visual impressions that I have of my nightmares, and then insert scientific visualization from geomorphologies of quakes. And at that time, there were a couple of big quakes where I live, so it was like just, and I was able to work with scientists and get and work with their data. So it was great. It was like a really exciting kind of bringing together cybernetic kind of project, bringing together scientific and aesthetic issues in one big blob. So that was a really exciting period, and that's what brought me out into the public world, I guess. So that was 10 years ago. So it's been a 10 year career. That's my career in full on being in having a public life. It's been that long.
Christina, it's really been a pleasure talking with you, and fascinating to hear about how you put this together and have come out. I want to thank you for making the work you're making, because it's really beautiful. And thank you so much for being with us today on this show.
Oh, well, thank you so much. I'm really, really, really honored. I'm very happy to be alive and very happy to be able to make this work, and love talking with you.
You're listening to Yale Radio WIBC. This is Brainerd Carey with The Art World Demystified.